method of policy. In our attempt to do that simultaneously, we were not very successful. But I sit here with an apology, which I personally accepted and discussed that the committee would, and from the Minister of Finance, and it reads as follows. The correspondence dated the 27th of September 2007, inviting me to be part of the discussion on the National Treasury's annual report in the South African Revenue Services, referred. I'm unfortunately not able to attend because Cabinet is meeting in Pretoria on that day. I want to, however, reiterate my previous statement about the importance of having the executive member come to Parliament to be held responsible for the findings in the annual report. I'm prepared to address the committee at another date, as I had done when we tabled our strategic plan. Should the committee still deem it crucial to have a discussion with me after hearing from the DGs and accounting officers and the department? I must point out, however, that this is an extremely busy time of the year for the ministry and the department, as we are in the process of finalizing the medium-term budget policy statement. I'm also going to be abroad due to international engagements from the 12th to the 23rd of October 2007, and will be hosting the G20 Finance Ministers meeting from the 16th to the 18th of November. And I therefore table the Minister's apology to this committee. And I tell that the committee accepts the apology. Am I correct? Okay. Therefore, I'm going to be listening to South African Revenue Services, led by the Commissioner himself, as usual, Mr. Kevin Gordon. There he sits, and those that have not paid their dues normally pretend not to know him. So, can you indicate where you are, Commissioner? Oh, good morning. We also have the General Manager of Strategy, Modernization and Technology, Mr. Barry Hong. There he is. We have the General Manager, Chief Operating Officer, Mr. Edward Kister. General Manager, Enforcement and Risk, Adam Pillay. General Manager in the Office of the Commissioner, Jenny Padish. GM Audit, Jonas Makwakwa. There he is. Law Admin, Chief General Manager, Kozilo. General Manager Customs, Leonard Kadeli. General Manager Communications and Corporate Relations, Logan White. General Manager Compliance Risk, Mandy Sanquen. General Manager Large Business Center, Matsubana Matra. General Manager Corporate Services, Mr. Ofa Mahashula. General Manager Finance, Prakash Mangri. General Manager Government Relations, Jimmy Ravel. General Manager Regional Coordination, Nathaniel Mabetra. They're all welcome. Our apologies for starting late. Parliament is just a return from recess. There is a bit of inertia. Some members not attending. And also to say that the committee is a bit thin. For the whole of this year, we actually have been having a very high turnover of members in this committee. Mr. Ian Davidson has since left the committee after a very brief stint. Officially informed by his colleague, Mr. Murray, that he started his training because he's taking up. What did I say? Oh, it's because, you know, it's not long after Mr. Davidson also left the committee. And Mr. Gibson also has left the committee. He's joining the foreign mission. I'm told he's going to Thailand. Am I correct? Yeah, so we've already started this training from the first of this month. So we are 50% short on the GA. A lot of other people. From the ANC side, our one member short, who has not been replaced, Mr. Gamchi left the committee, as we all know. But work continues. Commissioner, we are in your hands for the better half of the day.
Jefferson, thank you very much, and thank you once again to the committee for allowing us to present the annual report for 2006-2007 to you. And may I also take the opportunity to thank the committee for its visit to SARS a few weeks ago, which certainly we found very interesting, and we hope that it gave you a better insight into how the real SARS work on the ground, at least in part. And our staff certainly appreciated the interaction with you. We also meet at times when SARS is 10 years old. On the 1st of October 1997, your predecessors at the time in this very room passed a piece of legislation which on the 1st of October turned SARS into an autonomous agency. And 10 years later, you can see the fruits, if you like, of that decision. 2006-2007.
Happy congratulations and happy 10th anniversary to you.
So I'm saying it right at the beginning, so that you get a... I'm saying it right at the beginning, so the committee club will take note that at tea time you might want to offer us some cake.
You are going to offer some cake. I just want to clarify.
We'll negotiate.
So when you are young, up to the age of 18, your parents organize your birthday. And there's a department when you turn 10, you organize your own birthday.
Well, as you pointed out, Chair, the Minister of Finance is unable to join us, but he's aware that we are here, and he's aware of what he's going to say to you as well. 2006-2007 was an interesting year, slightly different from previous years, and in some ways the same as previous years. We delivered the money that we were required to, 496 billion rand, above the original target. It was also a year, Chair, in which we spent a lot of our time as a senior management team charting out a new direction for SARS and prioritizing what we think needs to be done in order to create a stable, sustainable organization. And that's the strategic plan that you referred to earlier on, which embraces what we have in mind in that particular regard. What that also indicates is that we want to hopefully move into a period of more organized change at a more fundamental level in terms of our processes and systems, which will enable us to offer to South Africa a more sustained revenue and customs administration than we might have been able to do up to this point in time. Part of that strategic plan was about reorganizing our operations. It was in this financial year that we also, towards the earlier part of the calendar year, made a decision to, if you like, take a deep dive into that part of our work which produces the most amount of money, which is income tax, and more particularly the personal income tax part. As a consequence, you see two pages, you see technology offerings, and other efforts on our part on the education, outreach, and assistance side to enable people to comply with the law as far as income tax admissions are concerned. But internally, as we go through the implementation process of this new system this year, we find that this is actually quite a profound change for our people, for our systems, and indeed for the taxpayers and practitioners as well. We, in many ways, are still, and we want to reiterate that as we've done over the years, Chair, that we are very mindful that we still an old organization. But notwithstanding that, I think we have a very enthusiastic team of people in the 14,000 that work for SARS, and the senior management team, who've done everything possible to deliver to this country, both in respect of tax collection and the custom service we offer. What I want to do over the next 15 minutes, Chair, with your consent, is to take you through the presentation which summarizes, if you like, the key features of the annual report, and then make ourselves available to interactions with members of the committee. On page 2 of the presentation, we point out that it was the Tax Commission in 1994 which originally said that government should consider creating an autonomous tax administration, with the current Minister of Finance then steered through the parliamentary process and the policy processes of Cabinet. The lower slide on page 2 looks at the context or background against which SARS operated in 2006-2007, and the slides that follow also look at some of the contextual issues which are covered on pages 15-27 of the annual report. So this was a year when economic growth turned out to be 5% versus originally anticipated 4.8%, where growth in employment was at 2.9%, and more people were working, and therefore more people were paying tax. The wage bill was higher, and that meant that on the personal income tax side in this particular year, we collected more money. The gross operating surplus, that's the amount of, if you put it in simple terms, profit, before certain types of expenses that companies were making was higher at 15.5% compared to 10% in the previous year. And on that slide, we indicate the sectors which in particular benefited or displayed that gross operating profit at a higher level. Imports were also higher, both indicative of the economic growth within this country, but also the higher consumption that our people engaged in. At the same time, the good news was that exports also grew in this particular year. So the economy remains, if you like, the key underpinning or driver of revenue performance, but is not the only driver. A key in any developing country context is what kind of compliance culture we are generating. And as we pointed out to you, Chair, on previous occasions, in a young country like ours, we are 10 years old, but the country is 13 years old. The kind of democratic culture, and one subset of that is the kind of compliance culture we have in a society, will actually determine whether, A, we collect taxes now, but also whether we can collect them on a sustainable basis over time. So a lot of our efforts is also about not just collecting money and tax returns, but also ensuring that we impact upon the mindset of South Africans, be they individual salary earners, small business people, or larger business executives, in order that they begin to understand what their contribution can be to building this culture. And generally, we can certainly report that there's still a gradual but very encouraging increase in the compliance culture, as evidenced in our own tax-based broadening efforts, closing loopholes, which result in less money being lost. The increasing figures that we see on the registration side, which we'll talk about in a moment. And although some effective corporate taxes still give us a few sleepless nights, on the whole, we've seen important improvements in many sectors. On page 3 of the slide, we briefly look at what were the trade policy changes and the tax policy changes that we had to give effect to. Often we ignore this, and we just talk about the money we collect. But our task is also to, on the one hand, contribute to policy changes, but on the other hand, act as an efficient implementer of the policy changes. So you'd be aware that there was an MOU with China, which imposed new responsibilities upon us at the customs level to ensure that the quotas contained in that MOU are abided by, and if they're not, then we are in a position to take the right kind of steps to ensure that those who transgress those rules are dealt with. There was a SAFU European Union deal or EFTA deal. There was an extension of the tariff, textile, and clothing quotas, and the others are listed there, so I'm not going to go through that. And all the policy changes which you approve of post the budget then implement it by ourselves. And some of the ones that we will talk about are tax amnesty for small businesses. And quite importantly, the implementation of the anti-avoidance rule, which is just beginning to take effect, but also renegotiation of double taxation treaties, which will enable us to implement the new dividend regime in the future. The second slide on page 3, it reminds us of what we said were the challenges last year, for this particular year. And you'll find that many of these are addressed in one way or another. We continue to encourage our staff to display the best integrity and public service orientation at the value of the structure of it. We make our efforts, as we did through the small business amnesty, to sustain extend the compliance culture in the country. More importantly, take every opportunity to make it easier for taxpayers and the public to interact with us. But at the same time, a very important part of our responsibility is also to discourage people who have any temptation to go in the wrong direction, and the audit figures indicate that we have done that fairly well. Similarly, on the customs side, we said that we will increase visibility, increase our enforcement capacity, and we'll see in our report for this year that we've certainly done that. On slide 4, we give you a breakdown of the various taxes. There's only three that I want to point out to you, which are the bigger ones. Personal income tax, which makes up 28% of the overall revenue take for the year. You can see the original estimate in February 2006 was 133 billion, and we ended up with 141. Corporate income tax, just under 96 billion, and actual outcome 120 billion, 23 billion more. And value-added tax, 131 billion, ending with 134 with a 3.2 billion surplus. On the next page, as we traditionally do here, we point out the key macroeconomic indicators which are developed by the Treasury and are part of the budget review and the medium-term budget policy statement. And here again, I want to just point out four that have a direct impact upon what we collect on the revenue side. The final household consumption in the original budget figure in 2006 was 4.9, and you'll see that the eventual one in the last column on your right-hand side turned out to be 7.3. A little lower down is the gross fixed capital formation, 9.4, turned out to be 12.7. And these are in infrastructure investments made both by government and by private sector. Import, 9.4, originally anticipated, turned out at 18.4. This has a huge impact upon VAT, but also has an impact upon refunds of VAT, not just the collection of it, depending on the type of import, in this case, capital goods. Inflation, originally anticipated at 3.9, turned out at 4.6, which does have an impact on the nominal amount of money that we actually collect. In the next slide, we point out the key factors that were driving the increased revenue collection in this year, which some of which I indicated earlier on: higher employment, higher remuneration, higher business profitability, greater consumption by our people, more capital distribution by companies, which leads to higher FDC, and higher imports, as we just pointed out. On the operational side, Chair, and this is now taking us into the next chapter of the annual report, pages 28 onwards, to the end of the chapter on page 37, we highlight the operations outcomes for the year. Clearly, one of the key ones is collecting the money, so that's 496, approximately. Better compliance, we had an overall register growth of 8%. In the annual report, we have details of each of the taxes and what the register grew by. You're very aware that, and thank you for also participating in some of the work that we did around the small business tax amnesty, the results of which I'll come back to in a moment. And a significant amount of our time and effort is now going into educating the South African public and assisting them to comply. I must point out that one of the things that's becoming quite prominent now is the number of errors that taxpayers make in their submissions to us overall, which is beginning to impact upon our own efficiencies and the correctness of the work that we emerge with, which then means that we've got to invest a lot more on the education side than we do currently. Improved service, the turnaround time overall is good, but we are training, if you like, and greater volume and lesser staff and no technology change. What you saw at the Elberton campus chair is the first of the indications of the changes that we are making, which will then begin to relieve some of that pressure. So processing of tax returns has improved, the turnaround time on grant refunds has improved, and the processing of income tax and PAYE payments have also improved, so that all of which means that there's more accurate accounting as far as the taxpayer is concerned. We've tried to reduce the compliance costs on individuals and businesses by the introduction of the call center, where volumes are continuing to increase in terms of calls people are making. E-filing, we still have a significant increase, but not as significant as we would like. But what's interesting here is that now 20% of our revenue collection happens through e-paying, and not happening through some of the traditional ways we need to collect money. We're working increasingly with practitioners and spending a lot of time at the moment helping them to understand the new e-filing system and how they can bulk file, and giving them various forms of assistance over that process. At the back office, we'll point out the figures here in a moment. We still have an increasing workload, which is not commensurate with the kind of capacity that we have at the moment. And it will take us, as we are learning now, a few years before automation begins to give us the benefits that we anticipate. Risk is also a key factor in what we do, because constantly we have to ensure that our systems are designed to prevent any potential revenue leakage. On the cost of collection side, you can see that for 2006-07, we spent one run and 0.04 cents per 100 runs that we collected for government, and the lower slide on page 6 indicates the pattern over the last few years. On page 7 of the slide, as we indicate in the annual report here, is the percentage growth in the register overall over the last few years. The number of returns that are being processed, 10 million in 2004-05, 15 million in 2006-07, and the revised assessments, almost 60% of the revised assessments are as a result of taxpayer errors. Although we must also admit some culpability, where about 20-odd% is through mistakes that we make within our own system as well. And this is what gives us the pressure, if you like, to automate on the one hand, but manage our risk effectively on the other hand. The lower side gives you some figures about income tax, VAT, and PAYE returns the previous year and the current year, and all of them, as you can see, indicate increases. On slide, page 8 of the slide is some indication to you about the number of workshops held on the taxpayer education side, and you can see that's quite a huge investment from our side. As far as the call center is concerned, 2 years ago, we were getting just short of 1 million calls per year coming into the call center. In this financial year, 2006-07, 4.2 million calls were made to our call center, and of course, taxpayers want immediate and quick answers, some of which we are able to provide, some of which our systems handicap doesn't enable us to provide. Page 9 of your slide is part of talking about the tax practitioners and the systems that we try to offer them, and there's some photographs there which indicate the kind of atmosphere that we experienced during the small business tax amnesty. I want to congratulate our staff, both throughout the country and the management team here, for an excellent piece of work that was done. There is no script on these things, but it was a very well-run campaign. On page 10 of the slide is the Small Business Amnesty result. 353 applications were submitted, 138,000 are in the process of being adjudicated. And one of the issues, Chair, was that we allowed people to submit applications without the backup document which legislation requires. And our battle over the next while is going to be to make sure that people submit those backup documents, without which we're not going to be able to give them the amnesty that they require. At the same time, those that have not taken up the opportunity that the amnesty offered them are going to increasingly experience the enforcement side of our business, because creating the compliance climate means that taxpaying and honest taxpaying South Africans want South to make sure that they act against those that are less than honest. The second slide on page 10 refers to the South Service Monitoring Office, which has over the last 5 years or so been our effort at creating an independent panel for taxpayers who have complaints about the quality of our service, to have a channel through which they can lodge their complaints. And there's a significant increase in the number as people become more aware that this facility is available. But there's also an increasing effort on the part of staff to resolve those issues within the turnaround time that we require. The large business center of the Matawa's Empire, on page 11 of the slide, is the place where the largest corporates have their tax affairs dealt with. 80% of the revenue that the LDC collects comes from 200 companies. And there's some interesting patterns where, on the one hand, we're collecting about, in that particular financial year, 137 billion rand from a few thousand companies, both in corporate tax and investment DAYE. But on the other hand, there seems to be a serious behavioral challenge in corporate South Africa as well, which the next two slides point out. If you look at the lower slide on page 11, the figure for 06-07 and then 2007 is that in the first instance, 72 companies in those various sectors that we indicate there didn't pay the right amount of tax at the right time. So you can see that in the earlier years there were 13, and those 13 are continuing with that behavior over the next few years, and that 13 is part of the 158 that deliberately pay less tax than their current profit situation would actually require them to, which means that the phenomenon called paragraph 19.3 implementation must be given effect to. And the result of that you see on the next page, page 12. And if you look at the third column from your left here, 15 billion rand is what came in as a result of the efforts of our staff at the Large Business Center in pursuing businesses. If we didn't do the work that they had done, this 15 billion rand would have been delayed by anything between 6 months and a year and being used as cash flow within a business to meet their own requirements, but at the expense of the system. So you get an idea, if you look at those figures, of the amount of money that was actually collected. On the customs side, it's been a good and stable year, and a year which lays the basis for more assertive changes over the next few years. And we discussed that on page 12 onwards on the slide. The Large Business Center was on page 52 of your annual report, and customs is on page 59 of the annual report. The turnaround times for imports and for export processing have all been in line with our expectations, and they've even improved on that. We are getting better profiling and targeting of consignments, but clearly we still have an antiquated way of doing it, and we need to modernize our risk profiling. And we've just recently signed agreements with the UK and Sweden tax and customs authorities, which will enable us to bring in assistance from foreign countries to help us to get better systems going on this particular front. On page 13 of the slide here, there's been a substantial increase in the seizure of illicit goods. They cover counterfeit goods. There's an increase of 83%, DVDs and clothing. Cigarette seizures have had a very substantial increase. Narcotic seizures have also shown an increase. And I can report to you that yesterday, the detective dogs that we have now, about 8 of them, which patrol the mail center where international mail comes in, the Oliver Tambo Airport where passengers come in, picked up a passenger with 7.5 kilograms of cocaine. Although the announcement was made by the first in police service to finally arrest the culprit, the detection actually happened through the customs officer and the customs detector dog. So that was and this is happening more and more regularly. We're finding that there's a lot of drugs coming in through the mail and also going out through the mail. And increasingly, we hope to cooperate with our sister customs agencies elsewhere to get better intelligence, which will help us to get sharper detection of what is going on. You'll notice there's an item called Movate Cream. These are skin lightness, which when applied by our people, has a massive detrimental effect on the skin. And that's the protective part of the work customs does. And more we will detect these sorts of medicinal products coming in that should not be coming in this kind of way, and that can actually harm the South African public. As we point out there, the detector dog unit is now operational and will become a lot more effective as we extend that. And the customs border control unit will also, having done its preparatory work, begin to operate and recruit people later this year. The figures in terms of exports and imports and containers are contained on the lower slide on page 13. I don't intend to go through the details. On page 14 of the slide, we look at the examination rate, and again, there's a significant increase in the hit rate and our successes in respect of detecting transgressors, if you like. And the lower page on page 14 gives you some idea of the different types of products that customs officers see. You'll find a repeat of this under enforcement, but I'll explain that to you in a moment. On the next page, page 15, cigarette seizures, even products which transgress the Chinese treaty, counterfeit seizures, there's some details on the lower side, DVDs, clothing, footwear, and so on. Page 16 tells you a bit about what we are doing through Mr. Ravelle on the Border Control Operational Coordinating Committee, which he chairs on our behalf with other government departments. And increasingly, we are getting a more collaborative spirit going between agencies that work at the border. And there are six initiatives that are listed there, which that team is actually working on. The border control strategy, assisting in infrastructure development so that staff from all departments at the border have decent housing, decent water, and have access to decent facilities while they serve the country in very difficult areas. The setup of a national border coordination center will make a big breakthrough, particularly in improving our capacity to handle the challenges that 2010 will bring with it. And we're happy to report to you that a process that started during this financial year was concluded a few weeks ago when the presidents of South Africa and Mozambique signed an agreement that we will now implement a one-stop border post at the Zana Gasia Chotla Bombo. And those processes will now commence as well. And the second slide looks at various systems that need to be developed. On page 17 of the slide, that's the agreement that I referred to earlier on and how we're going to go about giving effect to it. And the lower slide looks at the infrastructure expenditure that I was saying is necessary in order to make things easier and better for all departments that actually operate at the border. Page 18 looks at the enforcement side of our business. Audit is still the most important activity that we get involved in. There's some 970 staff that take up 69,000 audits in this financial year. of which 13,000, as we point out, were inspections on non-compliant small business. We collect money or prevent money from going out in various ways, which results in that figure of 6.6 billion rand. Some of it comes in cash, some of it remains debt. Some of it is 1.5 billion actually, a refund that were stopped, which people would have normally got had the audit not been conducted. And that's an excellent piece of work, which makes sure that people who hook up their figures don't get refunds that they're not entitled to. On the criminal investigation side, there's a substantial increase in cases that have been prosecuted, but also in the conviction rate as well. The debt book will increasingly decrease, whatever you call that in English. But you have passed new rules in April this year, Chair, and those rules will now be given effect to in terms of writing off of debt. And the next few years, the debt book is going to look different, because effectively, as we tell you in the annual report, the debt that is actually collectible is about 11 billion rand, not the 63 billion rand that you actually see. On the enforcement side, there have also been very significant campaigns with limited staff. So TIC, I'm not sure if all of us are familiar with that, but that's the drug that our young people are consuming. That was confiscated, 270 million. Abalone, which Chinese young people are consuming, which is smuggled out of this country, 20 tons. And this is with very few people on our staff who are committed to this kind of investigative work. And as we increase our capacity, that will get better. The lowest price share tells you that 38% of our audits were on individuals and 62% of our audits were on businesses. And we outlined some of the sectors that were visited, if you like, by our auditors or had their books examined by them. And our business intelligence unit is increasingly having more success at identifying the right cases. At the bottom of the slide, you'll see that on the enforcement side, there's a hit rate of 68%. That means 68% of the cases identified and ended successfully. And on the customs side, it's 78%. On the next page, page 19, gives you an indication of the success rate of the business intelligence unit in the sector of different products. And all of this you'll find on pages 79 onwards in the annual report. The lower side page is interesting. It says that arising from the 69,000 audits that we have done, what do we find? And what we find is that on personal income tax, we still have people who do not declare rental income and earnings that they make from investment, because these are additional incomes that we might not be able to have independent information on. They cook up expenses so that they can claim deductions as business or as individuals if they're running their own businesses, or they overstate their travel, business travel, so that they can also get deductions. These are all things the South African public should know that we are very aware of, and we will find better and newer techniques each time and each year to identify through third-party data and other means those who actually transgress it. On corporate income tax, again, understating of income, manipulation of turnover and stock, fictitious expenses, falsification of invoices, and let's call it convenient interpretation of the legislation to suit the purpose that a particular company might want to set for itself. VAT, you remember we've always told you, is a popular, VAT law is a popular sport in South Africa. It's coming more under control, but it still remains a challenge in terms of overstating the inputs and manipulating invoices, engaging in fictitious exports, and manipulating other figures which result in refunds which they're not entitled to. On the PAYE side, we have, let's call it aggressively structured salary packages, which means that people pay less tax than they're actually supposed to, and particularly at the higher levels in the income structure. employers are deducting PAYE but failing to pay that money over to SARS. That, as you know, in terms of our current legislation, is a criminal offense. And more we will identify these people and charge them in court. Or there are additional employee benefits that are not on the record, so to speak. The money is paid out, and that money is then not taxed by the employer. On the next page is our criminal investigations check, and you can see the number of cases that have been completed on the one hand and prosecuted on the other hand. And currently, our colleagues in the National Prosecuting Authority are able to provide an 87% success rate on prosecution. And we hope that in collaboration with them, we can still increase their capacity to take on these very technical tax matters. So the lower slide gives you an indication of the types of cases on VAT, on under-declaration of income, on customs, and on PAYE. On page 21, we break down the debt figures. And as I indicated to you, the collectible debt is more like 11 billion than the original figure, in this case, 57. But this will look much more different in a year's time as we get the new legislation implemented. Notwithstanding that, 17.7 billion rands in debt was collected this year, in this financial year compared to the previous year, it's 4% higher. And as I said, we will implement the new regulations during the course of this year. Page 22 of the slide covers again the types of seizures that our enforcement people have been able to accomplish in this financial year. And the lower slide looks at Mr. Lowe's endeavors to complicate life for South African taxpayers in bringing you very complex large pieces of legislation, which I believe you're going to be looking at shortly. But in this financial year, we had the general anti-avoidance rule and all the other things that you see there, Chair, and also double taxation treaties with the countries that are indicated at the bottom of that slide. On page 23, we indicate that the advanced tax ruling system is now working. You remember that this was a key, if you like, enabler that we wanted to provide to business, who might say to us that the law is too complex, and that's why they actually engage in dubious activity. Well, business now has the opportunity to come to SARS and say, we have this kind of structure or transaction in mind, and what is your view on its technical and legal acceptability? There are increasing numbers of people who are applying for ruling, but I think there's still a bit of hesitancy in the market, and this is going to require a culture change in terms of how corporates operate on this front. The alternate dispute resolution process chair has dealt with 352 cases in that year, in the tax court 176 tax cases, and in the high court 47 customs cases were referred. On the people side of SARS, page 24 of the slide, the key features are that for that year we had 14,709 staff, slightly lower than the previous year, and then you have a breakdown of permanent and temporary staff. Personnel costs covered just about 61% of our overall costs. And increasingly, as we bring better qualified people and more skilled people onto the staff, you're going to see that the personnel cost element is going to be impacted upon. 942 positions were filled during this year, but at the same time, we had about 935 people leave staff. At the upper end, largely for bigger packages and better career prospects elsewhere in our economy. So we have a turnover of about 6% within the organization. At the moment, we're comfortable with that. But as we put in better systems to retain people that we want to keep, hopefully some of those figures will actually change. The lowest side indicates, Chair, that our absenteeism rate is lower than the national average, 3% versus 6.5%. So maybe me being an ex-pharmacist is helping to keep people at work by issuing panados and whatever else to them. Don't ask me difficult questions. No, I'm not a registered pharmacist any longer, so unfortunately I can't. And then, as I reported to you on previous occasions, in terms of the employment equity picture, we're looking at South being in a much better position than before overall. And you see the figures there, black 68% in grade 9, 8 52%, 7 50%. And in each of these cases, Chair, we've set very clear targets and we're very confident that we will meet those targets. Page 25, and looked at our property portfolio, and the way the residential side is made up, that's largely customs people, and where our offices, the number of offices and so on are, and we constantly are aiming to improve the accommodation in which our people work so that that will lead to better productivity. On the technology side, Mr. Ho is trying to make sure that the technology delivers what the business requires, and we constantly looking at possibilities of improvement. But our biggest challenge will be our old business system, which requires a couple of billion rand to be invested over the next 10 years, and that's where the big choices need to be made about whether we will get that money. And would say that government wants us to place itself in a better position than we have currently. We also indicate there that there's a focus on third-party interfaces so that we can do better data matching than we currently do. The SAP system has been upgraded to process payments from all the channels through which payments actually come into SARS. And we're reviewing contracts with our suppliers to make sure that we get best value for money. I must report to you, Chair, that more recently we had an interaction with a technology provider, and it's fascinating the arrogance with which some of these providers operate, where because they know that we might be inverted commas hostage to the software that they actually provide, they behave in an extremely arrogant and uncooperative way. And I don't want to name names at this stage, but I think Parliament might want to consider calling some of these technology suppliers and asking them what is their relationship with government, to what extent do they negotiate on a bona fide basis, and to what extent do they hold us hostage in terms of pricing and the kind of contracts that they force us to sign sometimes in a very uncooperative spirit. On the corporate relations side, there's some indications of what we've done. In the last year, we've tried to engage with CEOs of some of the major sectors of our economy, and we'll continue to build on that. And on page 57, we cover some of the marketing highlights. Finally, Jay, in terms of our finances, for this financial year, we had an unqualified audit opinion on our own accounts and on administered revenue. We're happy to also report that there were no emphases of matter either in the own accounts report from the Auditor General or on the administered revenue report from the Auditor General as well. And those matters we cover on page 28. Page 29 indicates how we used our money, but also we conclude by giving you some indication that notwithstanding the challenges that we face, we are working with our neighboring countries, both in Southern Africa and elsewhere in Africa, to improve their capacity as well. Finally, where are we going? We've indicated to you in the strategic plan that we presented earlier this year our ambitions for the modernization program. But what we can report to you is that in this financial year, we conceptualized that modernization program, and two elements of that modernization program were initiated, and we're now working through it this year. The one some of you or all of you have seen, which is the new income tax assessment program, the implementation of scanners on the Overton campus, and the changes that we've made to make it easier for taxpayers to comply. And the second is the service program, which will replace our call center software, but also in time, over the next 18 months or so, enable our call center people to give a better service to taxpayers by answering their questions to a larger extent in terms of resolving the queries that they have. What do we see as the challenges for the year ahead, or the period ahead? One is clearly we've learned from the Small Business Amnesty that there's a lot more work to do in extending the tax base in South Africa. But also the star needs to increase its presence in more parts of the country. And in the next 18 months or so, we hope to develop plans, and depending on whether we have resources, to extend the footprint that we would follow. The second is that corporate South Africa is still falling behind best practice in certain parts of the world, in that the issues around tax and tax compliance and tax planning is not sufficiently on the corporate governance agendas of boards of companies in South Africa. And we hope to do a lot more to interact with those companies and those boards to expose them to what's happening elsewhere in the world on the one hand, but also to indicate the urgency for them to bring tax onto the corporate governance agenda. The filing of tax returns, bringing in new technology and new forms is one thing, but what we are clearly learning here is that the errors made by taxpayers and practitioners has a major impact on our own productivity, and we need to work with taxpayers and practitioners to get those errors down. But also, employers will need to do more, to give us more data and to give it to us electronically so that we can reconcile what people give us on paper with what the employers have on their record. We always will have a tension between providing better service, but in doing that, making sure that our risks don't increase. And so finding the right balance between providing better service, making things easier, making things faster, doesn't result in our risk of losing revenue increasing at the same time. The modernization agenda, we've indicated to you how we try to get the resources that we require and build the management capability are the two very important challenges ahead in terms of creating a more sustainable institution. We have very good cooperative relationships with many government departments and entities, and we hope that we can extend that even further and bring about better synergies between what we have and what they have so that the people of South Africa and government as a whole can actually benefit. And even with our limited resources, finally, to extend more capacity building assistance to our colleagues in other parts of Africa. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Are you perhaps to be giving an opportunity to any of your to add or
when we interact,
then members, we have a question, comment, the part talking to the strategic plan, where are we? Mr. Mgudi, Mr. Maria, Mr. Malato, Mr. Lidi, and then
my question is, of the 200 companies that actually are being blamed to pay their dues, what strategy do you have in mind other than keeping the, the government issue on that that they pay their dues in time to not be blamed for this month again? And my second question is on the education part of it, but for the 7 cases that have been high cost, and most of the cases actually there were some effects in your paper is only a few that you know. How much did it cost for the education? The last that my last question is on the the issue of the cabinet resolved that the staff will be a lead agency in water control and other issues. Now, what is the issue in international law? Revenue collection agencies in charge of the border control, or is the police or the army?
I think generally, one must congratulate the commissioner and staff that they have a superb year. There's obviously a lot of things that one can take out and congratulate them on. I think the one thing, chairperson, is the revenue collection that is absolutely superb. Maybe if you can just elaborate again on the contributing factors that have led to this huge increase in collection, specifically on personal income tax and then corporate income tax, where corporate income tax is now, I think, about 4.5% of the total tax that you collect. And specifically, if one can link this to what you have mentioned as tax relief. Now, we all know eventually the in the street must carry this burden. So it seems like there's an increased burden on the consumer. If we talk about tax relief, maybe if you can just put that in the right context and just comment on that. Then secondly, you mentioned about your employment equity and in your annual report, page 106, you referred to all your different levels and race and gender as well. I must say it's quite disappointing to see on the next page about the disability portion that you know it is number, and I think we need to know more about that. How many that must be broken down into gender and race and level of staff as well. So I must know. What is that competition? How does it really go? I mean, it must not just be cleaners, with all due respect. One wants to see all the levels. How do you position them there as well? Then in terms of the debt to revenue ratio, it has gone down and it's doing well. And you have said that in terms of the decisions in April, there will be a new movement. If I'm correct, the international benchmark has reached 7%. Will SARS be able to reach that target, that benchmark of 3-7%? And how will you do it? And when do you expect that to materialize? And then the last issue is, that's just on customs. And without referring to a particular case, on page 15 of your presentation, you refer specifically to the seizure of vehicles, which is quite substantial. And I would very much like to have more information on that. In other words, where did the seizures take place? Is it a specific type of vehicle? Is there a specific thing that we should be aware of that is happening in that sense? Now, to go further on that point, in South Africa, we know there's a huge lot of imported vehicles on our roads. And surely we can't seize all vehicles that is imported vehicles, purely because we're not sure whether they are illegal or legal on the road. And obviously, we cannot do that if normally law-abiding citizens don't have original registration documents ready. We also obviously cannot also expect of them to be without a vehicle if they are law abiding, but of citizens if they have bought a vehicle lawfully and legally. Now maybe you would just give me the procedures that how do you operate, how do customs operate when I mean, certainly they must get a suspicion that a vehicle is illegal. They must have substantial information to support any action by infringing on the private life of individuals. In other words, you know, you can't just do that because you think so. You must have reasonable information and evidence as well. And maybe you would just tell me about that procedure. And then specifically, how do you deal with how do you deal with officials in terms of their job description? How do you make sure that they don't go beyond that mandate? And lastly, will you put in a commission of inquiry should there be reasonable evidence that wrongdoing and misuse of positions was in fact happening? Thank you, Chair.
Can you switch off your mic? Mr. Pollock.
Thank you, sir. My question is based on page 9 of the annual report. In the annual report, you're indicating that there are some risks and challenges with regard to property sales and getting the right rate for those property sales. My question is whether in your endeavor to address this problem, have you made any attempt to interact with stakeholders that are involved in the sales and bond registration process? Don't you attempt also to get third-party information, even from the deed office, to ascertain the real value of this property? My second question on page 188 of your financial statement. You said that there's been an impairment loss of 2.5 million for certain software problems. I just want to find out what is the circumstance that led to the impairment of the computer.
And my last question
would
be on page
77 of your annual report. My last question would be page 77 of your annual report. You're saying on the 1st of March 2007, the pilot project was launched between South Africa, Malawi, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe to test the SADC transit system. I just want to find out what is the benefit of having this transit system.
Mr.
Lewis,
thanks, sir. Thanks for the opportunity. Commissioner, on your slide, upper slide 7, the first one, you mentioned that 20% of the revised assessment falls here are done through your very own system. So my question, if I heard you correctly, what measures are being done to reduce this figure to a minimal level? That's my first one. But the second one, again, on your page 10 of the slide, it seems to me that South has taken the hard line for people who seem to be not less honest, as you refer. So in your stress plan, you refer to a small business focus. However, why is the section of your annual report devoted to discussing with the large business center, which to me is should be another priority area in your stress plan, but no dedication is being made to discuss this issue with the small business, to empower them to provide mechanisms for the
the compliance, because for me here, I hear you correctly, since this on the out of the 39% that has been adjudicated, since this already the hard line here has been taken to bring this small business people. Yet the mechanism here is being made on your report page 66 here, that there is an interaction, an ongoing interaction with the business on the matter of tax behavior and so forth. Thank you.
In the absence of seven hands, can we respond to this? And then
thank you. My colleagues will now wake up and do their bit as well.
And pay for their No, they just have to pay for their flight tickets.
Yeah. Thank you very much, members, for your question. Let's go through them. And on Mr. Nguni's point about companies that are not playing the game as far as 19-3 payments are concerned, I'll ask Mr. Markowitz to comment as well. But generally, our approach is to engage with them through our sector relationship managers, to try to talk to CFOs and make them aware that there's a practice going on, and sometimes even the CEO as well. But we can see that all those efforts are not really paying off, because it's just becoming an endemic behavior. And we will have to raise the matter to higher levels within those companies. Also perhaps consider changing the legislation so that there's some penalty of a more severe order than we have at the moment, which will disincentivize this kind of behavior. I hope we don't get accused of taking a hard line there, but that's the only way we can get these things done. But Mr. Matwa, would you like to answer?
Thanks, Commissioner. Thanks, Jeff. I think the other thing that we're doing consistently is to monitor the newspaper articles in terms of how these companies are performing. Because the issues that we've seen is that they have a tendency of underestimating. Now, one must also observe that one of the difficulties that these companies are experiencing is to be able to exactly tell us the profit they intend to make going forward. Because if they declare an amount, our role is to say, is it reasonable? What are the information we need? So we engage with them. And I can tell you, can see from the interpretation, by the fact that we start challenging the numbers we get from them, as Commissioner mentioned in plan, we are able to bring additional money. Now, to me, is the committee has the power, obviously, to take influence in the situation. If this practice continues not to be what we expect, we might not be able to succeed. We might actually resent to the change of the law. But also, I must also agree that we have expenses well in terms of the risk area. And I think if I mentioned three of the risk areas we've covered so far, it's many intellectual structures that these companies are maybe getting involved, and the transfer pricing arrangement that are taking place. And lastly is the structured finance transaction. Those are the major issues that we really need to make sure that we come to terms to address some of the non-compliance with finance that is concerned. Thank you.
On the question of cost of corporate cases, that financial year was about 60 million rand. On the question of the lead agency and what are the international norms, maybe before I comment, that Mr. Robert come in and earn his salary.
The emerging international trend, which is post 9/11, with a new threat emerging, but customs administrations in the world are moving away from just customs administration and taking up the role of border security. So I can give you a number of examples from extremes to moderate, from the U.S. To Mozambique, for instance. In the U.S., customs have taken over everything, but I don't think that's what we want in this country. we have been chosen because of the capabilities that we've got at this one. The second issue was following international trends. That's what the president said at the State of the Nation address last year.
To add that, Chair, and then just to elaborate on what my colleague has said, the trend varies, but in most countries we still have a multiplicity of agencies, immigration, police, customs primarily, but agriculture, particularly where you have islands like Australia and New Zealand involved, is very strong as well. Many countries are still battling with how you bring these together. If you go to Heathrow Airport at the moment, you will see a new sign which says UK border, and they're grappling with now who controls that border, and they're looking for links between immigration and customs. So there are a variety of models that are available, as my colleague pointed out. And there's no trend line because nobody has quite got the answer. But what is clear is that we need more cohesiveness amongst the border agencies, and we're trying to do our bit to contribute to that as a lead agency. Secondly, we need more and more advanced information, and the Border Control Center that has been set up will begin to take us in that direction, together with the technology projects that they have in mind. Thirdly, we need to be aware that we've got to manage people, we've got to manage goods, and we've got to manage security. That are associated both with goods and with people. For example, we've learned that in the UK, there's already an experiment with the United States as their partner at one of their ports where they are scanning containers on a 100% basis. Remember, at the moment, it's somewhere between 5 and 10 in different parts of the country, 10 of scanning. And that combines both radiological scanning and scanning of cargo. And there's a line of thought in the United States that all containers that come to the United States must be scanned before they leave the shores of the exporting country. That could be devastating if that is actually imposed for many countries around the world. But there are these disparate experiments that are going on currently. I think our own efforts to get better cooperation and build the sort of institutions that will give us that cooperation will certainly take us a qualitative step forward and place us in a better position to manage the kind of pressures we'll face with 2010. Mr. Marais' question, what are the factors that impact upon PIC and CIC? And those are best summarized on page 5 of the slide, where we indicate to you that there is a higher employment, that more people came into employment than in the previous year. But also people got paid better, the wage agreements were at a higher level than inflation. And also bonuses were higher in certain sections of the employment bank. The second thing we talk about is business profitability, which impacts upon corporate income tax, and we showed you earlier on that there's a significant increase in the corporate surpluses in this financial year compared to previous financial year. We also showed earlier that there's higher domestic expenditure as a result of higher consumption, and you'll remember that when we looked at the consumption figures on the household side, where 4.9% was anticipated, the outcome was finally 7.3% for the year. So people are spending more, and in that process, more VAT is actually collected as well. As far as FCC is concerned, that's very subjective, if you like. If a company decides to hold on to capital, and then you won't get too much FCC. If they decide to distribute capital, we'll get more FCC. In this particular year, more was distributed, and therefore we collected more FCC as well. Similarly, on customs duty, there is a higher level of imports, as was indicated earlier on, and that resulted in a slight increase in the customs duty that we collected as well. is tax relief a burden on everybody else? Well, that's the fiscal balance, I think, that the Minister of Finance tries to maintain, that on the one hand, we get the progressivity principle into our system, which is if you earn more, you pay more. The second element is that the lower ends of the income scale must not be overburdened, and is policy intent for almost 10 years now has been that as we find the fiscal space, as you would call it, the lower ends of the income bracket will benefit more. And you can see, I think, 8-9 years ago, the threshold was at about 18,000. This year it's at 43,000 in terms of people who pay tax. But also we've had very significant changes in the bracket that people have to comply with. And all of this has meant that overall there's less burden. But as we widen the tax net, as we get more people paying, as we get more people paying their right and fair share, which is all that we want to collect, not more than that, we will also find that there's fairness within the system. So overall, I mean, all over the world people say we don't like to pay tax. I believe South Africans are different. Most would like to pay tax because they know they're contributing to a better country. And with the smiles that I see around me, I'm sure I'm right. But I think that overall there's equity within our system. But we also have a structural constraint. And our structural constraint is that our base is a very narrow base. And it's only as the economy grows and there's development in our society, as we get more taxpayers earning money, we'll collect more money, and then the structure will begin to change as well. On the employment equity question and disability, we would certainly like to give you that breakdown that you require. You understand we don't have it here. But let me ask Mr. Matashula to address that question with you.
Thanks, Commissioner, and thanks, Chairperson. And yes, our employment equity is, in terms of disability, stands at around 1.7%, around 233 people. We are not required, obviously, to report on gender breakdown level and so on, but we'll give those details, as the Commissioner said, through to you. But safe to say that, Mr. Murray, it would be important to actually look at the, you know that the Labor Department has a new compliance model that they do and they rate organization based on a composite score. And people with disability have actually very low rating in that particular compliance model. So it would be, I think it would be of interest just to go back and see how they arrived at that particular rating. You know, that gives you an overall composite score for employment. Why the disability one is that low. But with us, we think we have made significant progress. If you look at the progress over the 5 years, we've almost tripled, you know, the number of people that we have employed with employment equity. Safe to mention also that among those 233, there are about 4 advocates, you know, who sit in those areas. One of our best specialists, actually, are one of the 4 advocates that are. So it's not only at a low level that we have people who are with disabilities. Thank you.
Then the debt revenue question, somebody was just showing me some of these figures, so we'll address that. Let him do that first, and I'll then ask if I wish to.
Thank you, Chair. Our present ratio is about 12%. The norm would be, yes, 3-7% with the state institutions at the higher level and the private institutions at the lower level. Our ratio on paper looks quite high at we are around the 12% mark. Now, one of the issues that make it look so high is the way the debt is classified. So, for example, the debt book includes debt under dispute. So, we have a project, and the proposal is actually with us presently, and we're working through it. This proposal will reclassify debt. So immediately something like 16 billion would not be shown as debt. And that would bring the ratio down to 8 to 9%, even in this year. So that's one of the things we'll do. We'll reclassify the debt, and we'll have new definitions of debt. Now, presently, in terms of the technology system, we actually do not have a debt system. We are working on it. Maybe in 2 years' time or so we will have it. But a lot of the work is done manually. So with the new debt system, we will do much better. And then the improvement of the capability of our people. Most of our people are administratively inclined people who have been for a long time in South and who will move into debt management. And I think it is possible that within 3 years we bring this down to a level that we can compare with the better state institutions anywhere in the world. Thank you.
So in fact, if you look at the figures we produced, and if you accept our figures for now, that 11 billion is a real collectible debt, and that's the criterion that we use, then 11 billion out of, say, 460 billion is actually around 2% already. So a lot of this depends on the classification. In a normal business, you're not going to have too much under objection. Our law, Income Tax Act, VAT Act, and so on, allows for objection, which means that disagree with an assessment, you can go through certain legal processes and you don't have to pay your money unless you're a particularly recalcitrant taxpayer. And we now decide to implement the pay now, argue later principle. So on the whole, I think we compare very well with the OECD countries that we compare ourselves to. On the seizure of vehicles, the first part of it, let me assure Mr. Murray firstly, before I ask Mr. Hadeva to address the details, that no seizure or enforcement action in SARS must take place outside of the law, take place on an unfair basis, take place in a way in which we show partiality to anybody, or in any way compromise the kind of integrity that we wish to see amongst our own staff. Secondly, that where we see any transgression of either the rules or the integrity that we expect, we will deal with the people in terms of the law. Either they'll be given a verbal warning, a written warning, or appear before disciplinary committees and have done to them what is required in terms of our approach on these questions. We might not get a so-called commission of inquiry going, but we'll certainly try to find out what went wrong, who did wrong, and even address that wrong. So I will not hesitate to send a colleague who might have done something incorrectly directly to the taxpayer and say, go and apologize. Or go personally as a senior person, even if there's a mistake that somebody committed on the ground, and meet the people concerned to understand what went wrong and how can we rectify it. But as we were conversing earlier on, we are a human organization. And with human beings, we are going to get mistakes, and we are going to get lapses of judgment. And maybe that's, we all need to put systems in place which will ensure that when those lapses do happen, the public is not unfairly treated. But there might even be instances where somebody overstepped the mark. But let me tell you that, and assure you, that will by no means become the norm. That might be the exception in certain cases, but we will not allow it to become the norm. On the technicalities of the application of the Customs and Excise Act, Mr. Hadeva will address that in a moment.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Chair. The issue of the second and motor vehicles that referred to page 15 of the presentation, the motor vehicles that stated there, it's the successful seizures of motor vehicles that don't belong to the country. The 152, as it refers there, is basically a small amount compared to the number of vehicles that we detain First and foremost, I must tell you that the Act is very clear that we detain second-hand motor vehicles for at least 42 days to allow the clearing agent or the importer to claim and produce all the necessary documents. If after 42 days those documents are not produced, we then move to the seizure stage. In this case, the 152 cars that are reflected here are the successful seizures following that process. I must say that this issue is a big problem in terms of customs work, because as you know, on a weekly basis, the stat tells us that in Germany alone, you get plus minus 6,000 cars that come on a weekly basis. And there's a lot of round shooting around this problem. And unfortunately, both the importer or the clearing agent don't follow in a number of instances the rule. The rule is if you actually bring the car back after it has left South Africa, it must have a temporary import permit for the period in which it will be used in South Africa. And if that is not there, of course, it allows for customs officers to detain the car. And in instances where the car must not be driven in South Africa, destined for outside the LNS country, it must be moved from Devon, likely by road haulier. As you know, we had a pending a case by the Department of Transport, and I'm happy to say in September last year, the Department of Transport did win that case, which then regulated that these cars must not be driven in South Africa.
Thank you, Mr. Mateta. But if there's any further information Mr. Mateta would like to share, you're welcome to approach us, and we can deal with that. But motor cars is a complex problem, because in South Africa, as my colleague was pointing out, we allow second-hand cars to cross through our terrain to our neighboring countries. And they don't all get there. Or if they get there, they find a way of getting back. So that's the first problem we're dealing with. In fact, if I had my way, I would just say that we're not going to allow second-hand cars to drop into anywhere in South Africa. And just because that then prevents that problem from affecting us, but it might have a negative impact on some of our neighbors. The second body that has jurisdiction here, apart from the Department of Transport, is also the South African Bureau of Standards, because the vehicles that come in must actually meet their standards. So from time to time, they will tell us to stop a particular vehicle, and there's all sorts of rules that needs to be followed as well. So there's also decisions by the DTI in relation to protecting our own motor industry, about what they would allow and what they won't allow. So, for example, certain European countries will allow both right-hand drive and left-hand drive cars into their country, Belgium, for example. I noticed when I was last there. But in South Africa, you're not allowed to drive a left-hand car on our road. You might be given a bit of a grace period, but after that, you've got to get a right-hand car on our road. And those are rules that were defined through state policy regimes, which we are then required to implement. So you'll find that if you go to Durban, for example, you might find several left-hand cars that are waiting, and then we have to find ways of either sending them back or disposing of them in some way. Mr. Malotta's question on property sales, given the property boom that we've had, it's actually a very good question. Mr. Mokwena and Mr. Makwakwa will tell you what they're doing about it. One from a risk identification point of view, and the other from an enforcement point of view.
Thank you, Professor. Based on the analysis, we have highlighted that there is a potential based on the GDP growth within the construction and property sector of 1 billion, which is out there, which is the things that needs to go out and collect. And in the last year, we had about 313 cases that were identified as high risk towards the property, and which was getting handed over to enforcement for collection. We do this by using various sources. One, we rely also from intelligence using our task force line, where people form and identify suspicious activities that we have to do. And in within the public sector will receive about 450 property tax activities, where the general public highlighted only things that needed to do, and which had led to these cases being highlighted as priorities. We also do trend analysis, but I would also like to assure you, Ms. Moloto, that we have third-party interface with the DIC registry, so whenever anybody registers, we have that kind of interface that we become aware of. And general alignment with other government entities do provide us with some form of intelligence to which helps us to build a single risk profile.
Thanks, Commissioner. As seen also on page 89 of the annual report, property is one of our focus areas. We have been working very hard with the information provided by our intelligence colleagues, and with dedicated resources in this area to study. And a lot of cases are already underway, and probably in the next year we will show the details of what are the outcomes of this effort.
There have also been efforts to talk to the estate agent board, for example. And I know my colleagues have also visited some estate agents and looked at how transactions occur. So there are discussions with stakeholders. But I think what we need to consider, if you like, from a policy point of view, is whether special reporting requirements need to be imposed on this industry. Which means that on a proactive basis, we are told whether person X came along with a bag containing 10 million rands in cash and paid for a particular property, because both the financial intelligence center and ourselves will be very interested in knowing where did the cash come from and who's walking around with this kind of cash. Some countries do have these reporting requirements, and that's certainly from a policy point of view something that we need to apply our minds to so that we get a better handle on where are these investments coming from, who's got the surplus cash, and where is the income that properties that are rented out accruing, going to, and whether they are in fact affected in income tax returns or not, for example. So I think we've started with the early days, we started that work, and then this reporting factor might have to be given greater consideration. Mr. Moloto then referred to page 188, the impairment loss chair. If you remember at some stage, we did report to you and on this where, I don't want to use brand names, but there was a particular software we were using on the call center side, which we're still using when we introduced call centers. In December 2005, this particular company signed a contract with us for the next few years, which would enhance that software and provide a whole host of additional services as well. That company was then taken over by another software company, and the people who took over the company that we were dealing with, whom we started talking to early in 2006, then said that the previous contract is not going to bind them, and that the additional services that we were expecting at a particular, at a negotiated rate, won't in fact be supplied. We had to then work within the law, DFMA, but also with some discussions with the AG's office as well, to make sure that we don't suffer any loss of a huge order on our side. We were then able to change the deal by having new software developed, which is currently being developed, to ensure that we would use the current software up to, I think, it's the end of this particular contract period, which is early sometime next year. But that meant that some of the of that facility in that software won't be used. So in accounting terms, we have to write that off, and that's what that impairment loss is about. What we're going to still do is to see if we can still recover, if you like, some of that theoretical loss by asking whether there are other government entities that would like to use some elements of the software. So that's still work in progress. But we've satisfied everybody concerned that we've done the right thing ultimately to get the best value for government and for ourselves through this transaction. So that's what I was referring to earlier on about some of the tough talking that Mr. Hall gets involved in and loses sleep over with some of these entities. On the transit system, again, what is the aim here? The aim is that the current regime means each country has its own import and export documentation. Each country will require different pieces of data. And it means that as goods have to move across, we make life difficult for people in terms of filling in a multiplicity of forms. So my customs colleagues, together with those from those countries, have been working on this static transit system. And in the first instance, introducing a single administrative document. So Sardero will tell you where that process is. But the aim is to simplify those processes and the transit of goods amongst the various countries.
Thank you, Chair. As a result of the decision that was taken in October 2006 to move SACU to Sardis Customs Union by 2012, one of the deliverables was, of course, the SADC system. And we launched it this year in March 2007, and we chose different countries that belong into different regional economic activity groups. So you see Zimbabwe, Malawi, they do belong to SADC, but also they belong to SACU. And South Africa belongs to SACU only. So we looked at the single administration documents as referred to by the Commissioner. We also look at the impact in terms of the proliferation of the regional trade agenda as pronounced last year by the AU trade minister. That has a lot of focus and a lot of impact in terms of how customs then pronounce itself in terms of the different tariff nomenclatures and, of course, different trade administrations around SADC and SACU. But this transit system was a preparation of a bold integration for SACU and SADC in moving towards the SADC Customs Union by 2012. Today, we have between the countries that are involved have tested the SADC single administration document, and I must say that it is working. But unfortunately, there are other systems issues that need to be in place before we can say the transit is in totality working. You must also remember that most of these countries, they get a lot of their imports via what has landed in Durban. Therefore, it's going to be starting in Durban and then move where either it goes to Zimbabwe or it goes to Malawi or it goes to Mozambique. And as I say, it's basically to make sure that there's a few problems around the regional integration and around the move to start a customs union by 2012.
The last few questions from CD. The first one is about the bias assessment and the errors that we make and what are we doing about it. And his voice and then the CC I will add to.
Thank you. Just to put the 20% into context, we noted in the presentation that of the just more than 50 million assessments that we have done, 6% of them had to be revised. So 6% of the assessments, 20% of that would be 1%, so it's about 150,000 assessments that return. Specifically, the Commissioner mentioned the number in relation to income tax. Last year we had to revise 8% of the income tax, of which about a fifth or 20% at this point is due to our own staff errors. Again, to put that into context, we assessed 5 million returns last year. So about 80,000 of those returns had an error caused by our staff due to caption. Part of what we have done and the benefit of that will and should be part of the new assessment program that we've witnessed is to, first of all, reduce the complexity of the information that both the taxpayer must supply us, but also that we must capture, to reduce the action capture burden. And then also, we've introduced a two-stage capturing process that sometime in the past we had to review because of the increasing volume. Because of the new scanner capability that we all have, the overall volumes over time that our staff capture will reduce. So it gives us again the space to introduce two-stage capturing and thus allow the possibility of flagging any error up front. So I think our aspiration over the next 12 to 24 months is that the amount of errors due to our own staff capturing should be reduced in actual time.
Let me tell you, ask one of my colleagues to tell you about an experiment that we've been doing to improve quality. Mabeshwa would like to, or Barry Ho want to talk about this control group that you guys have been working with.
Thank you, Chair. In looking at the work that people do, we have taken groups of people into a specific environment where we can look at the process end-to-end and measure the quality of the work that's done by what we start out with and what actually comes out at the end of the process, and look to understand the various different issues that cause error or throughput delay. And we've been running a number of those for the last few weeks, and it has given us a number of insights about what we could do better to make sure that our staff are more empowered to make fewer mistakes, and including how we present the information on the screens, and how people are trained, what are the standard operating procedures and others. And we intend to continue to use those processes to educate us on what we can do better to reduce the problems that we described.
So my colleagues are ambitious that in a few years' time they have a production line very similar to Toyota in terms of the quality of the output. We're not saving any particular car, but Toyota is famous for its lean production system. And they're the originators of process efficiency on the one hand and quality on the other hand. So, but when we have some time, we can share that with you, Chair. The last question was about small business. Now, let me again show the honorable member that we have no hard line. In fact, the whole amnesty approach is about a soft line. It is about saying that notwithstanding the fact that there is a law in this country which you should be aware of, and you know that ignorance of the law is no defense in the court, we have the Minister of Finance offering you an opportunity to rectify your historical position, forgive you for all of your taxes, and give you an opportunity to normalize and commence your affairs. The second point is that, in fact, in the document SARS program 2609, there's a lot of detail about what we will be doing and have been doing. So I must apologize, the annual report doesn't cover that adequately. But small business is now of equivalent importance as a large business, except that it won't give us the same amount of money. So what we've done is, Mr. Shabalala, who unfortunately is not here today, has been asked to take responsibility at a general manager level for small business. And in the next few months, we will, the small business program has been in different places. So we want to bring all of that together and make a lot more concerted efforts to understand further, because we already have some understanding of what the requirements of small business are and address that. But let's recollect some of the things that SARS and the National Treasury have done. We have a separate tax regime for small businesses, you will remember, where they only pay 10% tax if they are regarded as a small business corporation. And if they're below, what do you need to help me, a turnover of? No, but the small business corporation.
Yeah, up to 43,000 euros.
Right. 10%
between 43,000 and it was, I think it's about 150, it could be a little bit more now, 10%, and then above that is the normal company tax.
So firstly, you have a special tax dispensation for small business. Secondly, as you see from the annual report, those educational programs that we've talked about are all directed, when we're talking about businesses, to small businesses. The work done during the small business amnesty, where we told you there were weeks where some 3,000 of our staff were out there, were all directed at small businesses as well. In the budget this year, the minister announced that the treasury and staff will work on a new, let's call it, tax product for small businesses. And I'm sure we'll give you a further briefing on that as we move forward. There's been a vast retail package developed for small businesses. There's been a very low take-up, but that's designed especially for small businesses that have a cash-orientated business. There's been an opportunity to submit less VAT returns for certain categories of VAT vendors. In other words, instead of every month, you can do it four times a year, and so on. And that was, again, an effort to make it easier for small business. But you'll recall that when we introduced that to you, we said that there's a danger because you must keep the cash to pay if you're actually required to pay on that occasion. So like that, I think there's a number of efforts on our side in policy terms, in administration terms, to set up small business desks at most of our offices. Although we might not have proper facilities, at least there will be a sign there saying, if you're a small business person, sit down here and we'll give you separate assistance in order to address your concerns. So that's work in progress, and I agree with you that more needs to be done and to simplify matters without, and remember, simplification does enhance the service we offer, but it increases the risk as well, as I pointed out earlier on. So that's the overall balance that we actually need to maintain. And we feel that having had these few years of experience with small business and engaging with them, we're in a much, much better position now to, in a more concerted way, look at what we can do further to reduce the burden on small businesses. Thank you, Chair.
Actually, we would not be wrong to anticipate that perhaps in the future you would have a dedicated unit like we have for the large business, like the case of those units, considering the uniqueness of small business and also the lessons that you might have learned during the small business amnesty.
Let's say we have a lot of ideas here. It won't be the same because large businesses are fewer, and it's possible to concentrate the staff that handle large business into one big center and two or three smaller ones. Small business has the opposite principle. You need to decentralize in order to reach out to them and ensure that you create more facilities on the ground where they can interact with us and receive assistance, education, awareness training, but also technical assistance on the ground. What we will do is now have a unit at head office, which now manages all of these programs in a more coherent way, and develop products in consultation with small business, which are more in line with their own capability, but also meet the requirements of the law on our side.
For my own education, and in order to be able to respond to some observers who say that, even though on page 21 we say tax relief, it's a shame. I mean, because of the tax relief, contributions of the CIT collections as a percentage of total revenue declined from 36.1 in 2001-02 to 28.5 in 2006-07. But total tax revenue as a percentage of GDP increased from 22.9 in 1994-05, 95 to 27.7. In 2006-07, that the tax burden actually did not decrease. That's what the brother said. I mean,
in the economy as such. What would your comment be on
this? Well, because which end do you want to start? But if we look at PIC, as you correctly pointed out, Chair, that figure of 36 a few years before 2001 or 2 was 44. And if you compare that to PIC, that figure in 01, 02 was 17, but before that it was 11. So what we are doing is saying that the tax mix in South Africa changed over the last, say, 10 years. Where there was, and the ministers always said this, that there was a huge dependency on individuals to carry the tax burden. And what we are now doing is spreading it. And I think we've indicated to you in previous discussions that in more developed countries, what you find is that the black part, which in our case is around that 24 to 27 mark, over those years that you're looking at, in developed countries, that will be between 35% and 45%. So they collect more indirect tax and more consumption tax. Their corporate tax levels will be closer to 11-12% overall. And their personal tax is more complicated because it has social security contributions and so on within it as well. So that's the first point. The second point is that on the 27% that you actually referred to, there's also an argument amongst observers out there which says that that's too low because we are a developing country. The government has huge development ambitions for South Africa and to improve the lives of people. And that figure might have to be 35%, for example, in the view of some observers. But I think what we've had is a view from the minister that we are upping that figure from the traditional 25%. And that is still a viable proposition for South Africa today, that we're not taking too much out of the economy for government usage, and that overall there's still a balance within our society. And all our tax rates, Chairperson, are comparable, as we pointed out repeatedly, to jurisdictions elsewhere in the world.
Further question? Dr. Wood? Mr. Court, Mr. Lord, or Mr. Wood? I'm told they see outside. Shouldn't people bring in tea and then take questions? Maybe we should do that. Let's bring tea and come back. But I've got those names already.
SARS is very difficult as a government institution to exercise oversight over, your performance. And one has to spend a lot of time going through big reports like your annual reports, trying to find issues, trying to do it in a constructive way. But I suppose one of the lessons we've learned is that, on certain occasions 3 or 4 years ago, we were celebrating your annual report at the time and saying how wonderful you were. If you look at the progress you're making subsequent year, we realize that 3 or 4 years back you weren't very good at all, considering the progress you're making. So while one is very complimentary of the progress, one wonders whether you are really good yet. You're getting better all the time, but are you good? And trying to exercise the other side,
I know it's very difficult for opposition parties to pronounce good.
Well, as I said, you think they were good 3 years ago, but if you look at the annual report 3 years ago compared to the one today, it wasn't good 3 years ago. There's a lot of scope, and maybe there still is. But your own does acknowledge the temporary progress you continue to make. Yeah, trying to look at some of the bigger issues, I think firstly on the rand and cent side, we allocated a certain sum of money to you, and against that, you, in accordance with the PFMO, you established what you term measurable objectives. I think you put them down as targets in a somewhat unusual fashion, put them into a kind of scorecard system. But there seems to be some correlation between your scorecard and your strategic plan. So one can't fault you with that. And then, looking at the scorecard, perhaps you're fairly unique amongst government institutions, is that your targets, almost in every instance, are measurable in numerical terms. It's the problem we have with many other departments, that a lot of it is just wish lists, and it's hard to actually get a handle on to say whether they achieved it or not. And it appears that you've achieved virtually every target you set yourself. So the money we allocated, you spent well in terms of the improved plan. So, thank you for that. Trying to think of some international aspects, and if you ever come across some that you can share with us, four revenue collection agencies, we wouldn't mind getting hold of those. The one I do know of, which I came across a number of years ago, is that your total expenditure should amount between 1 and close to 2% of revenue. The fact that you're closer to 1, suggests that you are doing pretty well there. A couple of issues that I would like to touch on, however, regarding performance. You say in your annual report you mentioned four areas which you allude to as being reason for the additional revenues you could have given, as a function of Mr. Maria's question. But in the past, Mr. Maria, you kind of reiterated economic reasons. I'd like to just ask you to focus a little more on the compliance side. How much of your revenue gains and overruns are contributed to by compliance improvement? Because our mind goes back to the tax commission where he estimated, or the commission estimated, after some research, I don't know how to run it, there was a tax gain of some 15 billion, I think, way back then. Do you have any figure? Would be a question. I can ask how you estimate the tax gap to be. And that's just a bigger sense against that figure of how you are eating away at it.
And the other issue which I've tried to look at the performance on, which also members have touched on, which you've given answers to, relates to the collectible debt. You talk about due debt of 57 billion, but then somehow this is whittled down to an 11 billion, and I take it that that's just some estimate. I don't know how one arrives at that estimate, but it's hugely significant. You're suggesting to us that there's 46 billion, which we might not have to account for at the end of the day. And I do appreciate that one never collects 100% of bad debt. The fact that you're providing for 37.6 billion, and should you be providing if you don't expect to collect even a third of it? Under 24 plus months of debt, it's the single biggest amount of 27.6 billion. And and you're estimating 8 of it, which is just about a third, what would be the reason to expect you out of so much? And if that's linked to that, does the prescription apply? Or are you able to prevent that applying? for delinquent taxpayers who owe that sort of money. So there's a few questions around understanding the debt story and how much you were ultimately credited. The final issue on that, I think we've got to look more at the individual taxpayers here. It has been written, I'm sure, and I believe you have expressed a sensitivity towards the fact that one side says, this is the way we interpret this, this is the way it's going to be, and most of us capitulate, including myself. Even if you find SARS's explanation somewhat clumsy, it's the normal man in the street would be slightly overawed and perhaps can't afford it anyway to get the lawyers to come and fight you guys. So perhaps it seems that some people might be put in submission on this. One telltale factor might be that of people that capitulate to your rulings, how many of them are corporate who can afford lawyers, and how many of them are individuals who are probably disliked before lawyers? See, that's the sense of the next chair.
Ms. McCarthy.
Thanks, Chair. I think I should also voice what has been voiced already in terms of the efficiency of such offices. I've been to the one in Machete, and to the service that has been very splendid. And even the outlook of that is well represented there. The only thing that should be attended to, Commissioner, I think, is the question of space. It's too cramped. But the outlook of the office is very attractive. Yeah, it's very cool. Chairperson, I just wanted to raise a few questions. One of the questions will relate to the IT security management. I want to check how secure or efficient is your information security. There are very brief questions. The other one will be on your budget. Your budget. Per annum, how much do you spend on litigation? And under which circumstances would you consider to go to take legal action on which cases and so forth? The last question is a question. I want to check on page 58 of the report. There is somewhere where they mention that there are low-risk taxpayers and others are high-risk taxpayers. So I want to understand what you mean by that. During the small business tax amnesty drive, I want to check how many convictions have been made of people who did not comply with the tax, paying the tax. Your compliance model promotes voluntary compliance. What has been the teething problems that you experienced with regard to that model since you started putting it in place? Thanks for that.
Thank you. My two questions are quite minor, but I just want to oppose them for the sake of ascertaining the progress that SARS is making in these two instances. One, the saying that we are making an effort to clean up contact details of taxpayers to reduce the quantity of undelivered returns, and which is despite that as one of the reasons for the outstanding return book. I just want to find out what are the practical measures that you are taking to ensure that those contact details are current and relevant. The second question on taxation of deceased and insolvent assets. Though this is a small figure that has been cited here, the debt is around 6.1 million, which is 6.1 million, sorry, 6.1 million, which is a very significant amount of money. But you are saying that you will be looking at the whole issue of the operating system, the implementation of policies to address debts that have been identified and training of staff to try to improve your work in this area. I just want to find out what measures are going to be, the practical measures, have you put thus far in ensuring that you reduce one cost, one concern might be you don't want this type of debt taking over for your business without closing.
Mr. Mbun.
Thank you. I just want to make a follow-up on the issue of a small tech company. It was basically targeted to small tech operators of new operators. So far, I don't find if there's any progress as far as increasing the tax base as far as the small businesses are concerned. It might be very ambitious questions, but I don't find out from the agitators, 1% has been agitated. Have you put in our tax base and how many small tax operators as one of the particular targets to be small tax
Thank you, Chair. Let me start with the preliminary comment that Mr. Woods was making about are we getting better, are we growing yet, and so on. I think what he described perfectly is the trajectory of development of a state institution in the first 15 years of democracy in South Africa, where you had a state in the past that dealt with a minority in a particular way and a majority in another way, and where in a very short space of time, the same state machinery had to transform itself to deal with the majority in a very different way, as part of the citizenry of this country. The second, I think, he would be familiar, and so would many of you, that we've already said that we are a very old and well-established institution that has old systems, old processes, and huge people challenges on our side. And what our annual report each year will reflect is the progress that we've made against that background in turning it into a more modern, a more effective, and a more efficient institution, but within the constraints that we've been working with, which is, for example, that we have had no really significant investment in the technology systems in this organization. We're putting new computers. We're going to put in a new network over the next few years. But the old technology systems are still the base upon which we operate, which is, by the way, not too different from many other similar agencies around the world as well, where they also have huge difficulties in this area in terms of how they invest. One of the countries that we saw recently, in the next 2 weeks, will be making a choice of a partner that they want to bring in, who will bring in the capital resources that will be required for their own next 5 to 10 year transformation in terms of the system changes, which will change the infrastructure that they actually work on. Our strategic plans, on the other hand, set out our ambition or aspiration, which says that we do aspire to be developed commerce as world class as we can be. We would like to benchmark ourselves against those that have had these systems operating for 50 years or more. And I mean, if you take the same organization, some of us met it last week, and it's one of the European countries, they face a very different problem, where more than half their staff will be retiring in the next 5 to 10 years, and they don't have young people coming to the organization to create the supply chain effect. Now, we're the opposite. If you look at our average age in the organization, it's just over 30 years, notwithstanding the fact that we have some old-timers in our ranks, some of them in the senior. I'm becoming an old-timer too now. So, Chair, this is not about the annual report saying we've become excellent all of a sudden. All we're saying is that we still have a long way to go, which is always what I've told you, that there are many flaws in our system. I've always told you that as well. But what this team is very committed to is to making sure that notwithstanding those difficulties, we're not going to use that as an excuse. That within that constraint, we will still do our best to deliver what we can to the South African public. And it's this can-do approach that has been the success story of the 14,000 people that started. But it also costs to be a can-doer, because you don't spend enough energy at rebuilding the platform on which further work can actually progress. That's what the modernization program is about. So be assured, we have shortcomings, and some of them we've already talked about earlier in the day, and many of them we battle with through the programs that we actually implement. On the question of investment in the organization, this is a related question. The 1% is okay to sustain us for now, but if you look at the figures on our customs staffing, for example, in the last 3 years we've lost about 300 people, some within the organization to other posts, and others about 180 or so left the organization. And in the last 9 months in particular, or say last year, 18 months, there's been a lot of poaching of our people. So the private sector, as the economy is booming and they need the skills, they're coming in, doubling the salary, and people who have real value to add and experience on our side are now being tempted to leave the organization. And you can see our salary bill increasing as well as we try to retain those people and keep some of those skills within the organization, as I'll come back to. So those benchmarks are useful, 1 to 2%. But what the benchmarks often don't account for is the investment required to overcome a historical legacy. Australia, for example, at the moment, and they've got a change program going over the last 2.5 years, where they are spending a few billion Australian dollars. A huge program. So that's a far more advanced administration. But they have simple things like how do you handle correspondence within the organization to solve. So they're building new systems of case management, of correspondence management, and they've just extended that contract to now include an addition to their social security system, what they call superannuation in Australia. So if a country like that is spending billions of dollars modernizing its system, which are already much better established than ours, you can imagine the kind of investment we would require to move to a new footing. In a conversation with the head of another European administration in the past week as well, we were discussing the kind of system changes and challenges that we face. Now, they're a much bigger organization than we are. Their tax base is bigger. But we have a very similar view about how much we want to take on. Because the system changes, and that means people, processes, and technology, and the change management of those processes, Chair, are huge and complex. And sometimes the activist approach that we've taken clouds some of those challenges. And we're getting a much better feel. And the colleague was also saying we've got to move more carefully in terms of how many systems do we want to change at a time. So even in our own ranks, we're having very intense discussions about how much do we want to take on. so that we don't overload ourselves. So improving from 1.04% will be most welcome, and it will give us some breathing space, particularly if we have a three-year window, which indicates very clearly what we're likely to get over a three-year period. Because that, then we can actually start planning properly in terms of what we need to do, rather than a kind of soft start way in which we do. So we have very detailed plans about how the modernization program can work, but if you only get X, then there's only X percentage of that that can actually be put into place in any kind of way, and that does impact upon whether and how we can deliver on the changes that we actually require. On the compliance side of performance, I think you're very right. And in our context picture, we said to you that there's the economic driver, which is still a substantial driver, and you correctly point out there's the compliance driver. And we've always told you that the model we work with is the service education enforcement model. And the two-page form, for example, not asking people to send their IRP files and other documents in, is part of the service component. And hopefully that constant improvement and ability to reach out to people on the basis that we make it easier for you to comply will create confidence in the tax administration and in the tax system and get more people to buy in to the fact that they have to do their bit in their own particular context. So I'm hesitating because I'm thinking about, I was walking down the hotel corridor this morning and there's this business person who hasn't put his tie on coming out and says, "Oh, it's you. I was trying to do my tax return now." It works, you know, the e-filing system. So it's interesting. You meet strange people in strange places saying these things. But there's no doubt that we need to continue to improve the service, and that's beginning to work. And part of that outreach and education work, that will continue. But we can't carry on the ad hoc basis that we carry on. So we've got to look at some institutional form that this must take, so that we can give it more stability, but more importantly, give it consistency in terms of reaching out to people and doing what we have to do. The second part is that we need to create more and more disincentives. I think that the campaigns that my colleagues very creatively think about on the enforcement side, on the small business amnesty side, the work that the LBC is doing in specific sectors, identifying the 19-3 problem and other problems, our approach of actually engaging with business leaders and others, small and big, is one which enables us to look at them face to face and say, You want the government to deliver X, Y, Z, but you've got to deliver the revenue so that government can actually have the capacity to deliver. So, and if you don't, then clearly there's the laws, and we're going to start utilizing the laws. But more needs to be done in terms of more visibility on the customs side, more visibility amongst our auditors, a greater frequency of contact once in 8, 9, 10 years. So business is not good enough. Some of the international averages are around 1 to 3 years. If you're really going to get the behavior patterns right and the right interaction between ourselves and the taxpayer. And then, of course, the key on our side, which is you'll see this shift both on the tax side and the customs side, is how do we better identify this? And how do we do it with better information than we have at the moment? So the whole, there'll be a key thrust towards third-party data and matching that data. And so there's a whole lot of impediments in our way. But it'll take time. Hopefully we can just create a platform in the next year or two. And if we get the risk engines right, and on the income tax side, our colleagues have done an excellent piece of work this year, and it's something that we will learn from and continue to build over the years. That will place us in a much better position in terms of the tax gap as well. We've done no real estimates in the recent past. It's something that we'll look at next year again. But I think the nominal figures are still there. In every society, there is a tax gap. And I think we have a much better handle than, say, 3 or 4 years ago about what needs to be done, how it needs to be done, And there's the right level of creativity amongst our colleagues in approaching this question as well. I've spoken a lot to Mr. Pillay and Mr. Makwakwa on the question of debt. There's some questions around how we arrive at the 12 billion and how we explain the 27 and 8 billion. Perhaps you will need to address the prescription question as well.
Thank you. The first thing we do with the reclassification is, and this is easier than, or less problematic than the old debt, is that the debt under dispute, which is 15 billion. So, in my view, that's a less problematic one. We then come to the older debt, and we've made some estimates of what we think we can collect there over time. But those are just estimates. And obviously, if we classify debt in these ways, I mean, it doesn't mean we're not going to go after the money. We're going to go after the money. But it's an estimate of what we would collect. I think what we're trying to say is that over the last 2-3 years, we've stabilized the debt book. That the new debt that has come in, we have been on top of, and we've prevented the growth of the book. That with reclassifying the debt, especially insofar as the debt under dispute is concerned, we will focus the people, especially the more capable people, on the old debt and go after it using the new regulations that have been passed. Because prior to this, it's been very difficult to deal with certain types of debt. So the end of it, the debt has to be collected or it has to be regulated. Or if there is an assessment which is not accurate, then it has to be adjusted. So, in the end, all of these numbers are sort of end up in one of those solutions. We will see a much bigger focus on getting to grips with the older debt. In the next few years. So, in my view, and maybe Jonas could come in on that, in my view, the first thing is just by dealing with the debt under dispute in the reclassified way, we'll reduce the percentage to about 8%, 9%. We then tackle the old debt perhaps over the next 2-2.5 years and really go at it and really cut it up. But at the end of it, it's got to end in either a write-off or actual collection or an adjustment if there's any mistake in the system or with that. Jonas?
I want also to add that the debt in that category of 24 months plus, the bulk of it ends up being in estate debt, where either the individual is deceased or the company is to pay. And the challenges are that to finalize that type of category depends on the third parties. For example, the master's office, there's a process that needs to follow before we can actually finalize that. So those are some of the challenges that we face. But on the other hand, we have made available ring-fence resources that are actually dedicated to actually make sure that we clear that debt either through collection or through the write-off process. Thank you.
Jonas, can you also deal with a lot of questions on the state? How are we dealing with that?
Yes, the upfront funding that we have done to actually ensure that there is improvement on how we deal with estate. For example, we have established a council, we call it the fiduciary council, which involves the stakeholders, involves the master's office, the bank, and all the related stakeholders. And then internally, we have established structures, the management, which was not there before. We have also recruited new employees that are being trained to actually specifically focus, because this is a specialized area that it's not easy to even get resources outside that are experienced. So we have to build our own resources. And we are continuously improving the processes, policies, and procedures. Much progress has been made in this area.
Dr. Woods' last point was around interpretation of the law and being bullied into submission. I can't see him ever being bullied into submission, but as an old friend. In fact, the contrary is often the case. Remember that there's a huge imbalance between the skills available to the taxpayer in South Africa and what's available to staff, particularly corporate and upper-end income earners. So they have access to the best tax planning, lawyers, investment banks, accounting firms, and overall, throughout the world, the tax administrations are at a huge disadvantage in relation to the overall skills balance. So I think we should get some perspective into that. The second, of course, is that our constitutional regime gives taxpayers the right to go to the highest court in the land, the constitutional court. In some cases, have ended up there. If there is a strong view about a particular principle, but I take his point that there are many people who might not have the financial resources to take that on, and that's where our own integrity and our own ability to generate a culture of fairness and impartiality on our side, and certainly eliminate any bullying element, plays a part. Now, we won't always succeed. There will always be just that little edge where somebody crosses over. And culturally, these guys, the enforcement chaps and the customs chaps are the chaps who, and I mean chaps in a gender-neutral sense, might have a tendency to be tougher. But they also have a cultural problem of their own, because they're not tough in what they do. And are too soft, and they're not going to be taken seriously either. So, technical interpretation, I think we are constantly open to challenge. And there are times, and that relates to your next question, which I'll get Mr. Lowe to come in on as well, that's where rulings and litigation come in. There's a question that was asked, I think, by Makoto. And that is, when do you go to court? And when don't you go to court? Now, sometimes you go to court, as my colleague will tell you, so that the court can say what the interpretation should be. And that, too, can end up at the Supreme Court of Appeals, or even higher than that, if either party feels strongly that the view that they've had up to a particular point in time is actually not good enough. So, the overawing factor often happens on our side at this point in time, but culturally, we want to make sure that we don't abuse or over-exercise, I'll put it that way, the powers that are within the various pieces of legislation that we have. And we're trying to develop better surveillance methods, if you like, to ensure that the taxpayer is not disadvantaged purely as an exercise of muscle. As opposed to the application of the law. But Mr. Lowe, two issues, one that afterwards about rulings and other corporates and individuals, and the other issue about when do we go to litigation.
Thank you, Chair. If we start with the second one first, SARS almost never been institute litigation, you know, from its side as a, or initiate litigation from its side, you know, from its side, especially when you deal with it from the tax side.
it is actually the right of every taxpayer, if the taxpayer is not happy with an assessment, to object to his or her assessment. And that's how a court process actually started in from a tax environment. Obviously, if the taxpayer then is not happy with the assessment, as I said, he or she can object. SARS must then decide whether it's going to allow or disallow the objection. If we disallow the objection, then the taxpayer can appeal to, first of all, there are two special types of courts that have been created to deal with tax matters. There's first what we call a tax board that deals with the smaller cases where the tax involved is less than 300,000. We've now recently actually increased the number to 500,000. It's like a small claims court, and the process is very informal. Each party can go to the tax board on his or her own. You don't have to bring a representative or a legal representative. You could state your own case there. So from that side, we're also trying to make the legal process much more accessible for the man in the street. If the amount is higher than 500,000, the person can appeal to the tax court. Even in the tax court, it is not necessary to have a legal representative. I mean, the taxpayer can actually present his or her case in the tax court on her own. In the tax court, of course, there is a judge of the High Court who is a presiding officer and who deals with the matter. And then, as the commissioner says, if a party is not satisfied with the decision of the tax court, you can go to the High Court, or you can go to the to the Supreme Court of Appeal, or ultimately to the Constitutional Court. So that's normally how a litigation process starts in the tax environment. As far as the ruling system is concerned, there are different avenues for rulings in SARS, broadly two sort of categories. First of all, and the Commissioner alluded to that earlier this morning, there's a process of an advanced tax ruling that a taxpayer can apply for now from the 1st of October last year. That is a binding ruling then on the taxpayer, on SARS. Once we've given the ruling, it is binding on us. And those are more in respect of transactions that must still take place. That's why it's called an advance ruling, so it's a transaction that the taxpayer still anticipates. Secondly, there are various options for people to obtain non-binding rulings on all the different taxes. Something that I also just wanted to mention in the litigation route, it's not an issue that we, at the end of the day, want to almost force the taxpayer in a specific direction, or that the taxpayer should, at the end of the day, almost capitulate his or her standpoint or viewpoint. We are more and more making things open to allow taxpayers a full opportunity that their cases can be heard. We now even have a non-litigation route where taxpayers issues can be resolved in what we call an alternative dispute resolution process, where we try and resolve matters in a non-litigious way, because often in a court environment it's a very adversarial way to resolve your matter. This almost brought in a process of sort of mediation where you have a facilitator. That will facilitate, the resolution of the dispute, where the taxpayer and the commissioner's representative get around the table and they try and resolve the matter, outside the court. So more and more we try and make the process open and accessible so that we can resolve taxpayers' dispute in a fair and an open way.
Thank you, Mr. Lowe. IT or Information Security, Mr. Hall.
Thank you. Clearly, the question of information security remains fundamental to SARS, given the nature of the information event. I'd like to just draw your attention to page 139 in the annual report.
there we lay out a number of actions SARS took to improve its information security in the year under review. But the question is very good, and we will continue to need to focus in this area. Exactly how good we are, and that we'll only know when we find out if we've been penetrated. It's a constant game of safe maker, safe breaker, and we need to continue to try and ensure that we are more secure and can prevent penetration. I think the key thing is making sure our staff are aware and are following the procedures, because often in these cases of information security lapses, it's not necessarily the computer systems that are where people get access, but it's through procedures and processes that are not being accurately followed.
Some of this share will also be related to changes in our technology system. The system is old and it might not give us the audit trail that we require sometimes and so on. So as we modernize systems, you can put in more modern information security measures as well. But fortunately, we haven't had any major glitches up to this point in time. Low risk and high risk taxpayers. What do we mean and how do we define them? For example, if a person receives just a straight salary, then that's, as far as we are concerned, a low-risk taxpayer, because there's no expenses to play around with, and unless there's some additional income that we might be unaware of, there's very little risk. At the opposite end of the scale, if you have a salary, you have huge investments, you have multiple businesses you're involved in, and you're a director in many companies and so on, the question is, are you representing all of that in your income tax return? Similarly, if you are involved in an industry that has a propensity to engage in structured tax products because your competitors are also doing it, or whatever is the reason, then you're also a high-risk individual or business. And on a worldwide basis, there's a lot of experience now to classify different categories of risk. And the compliance model itself does that in some ways as well. If your record shows, like I think I've used this example with the committee before, that your bank will know how good a creditor you are. Because you borrowed money to buy a house, you borrowed money to buy a car, and you've been paying that over many years, and they'll know whether you skipped installments and for how long you skipped them. And in terms of not just the new credit legislation, but of their own management of risk, they will know whether they want to lend you more money or not. Similarly, on the tax side, some tax evaders and aggressive avoiders are well known to us, and their records speak for themselves. So they will have to be dealt with in a high-risk way to make sure that we are careful about refunds that we pay out or the way in which we accept what is written on a piece of paper. Similarly, there are high-risk industries as well. So certain types of industries do things in a particular way. And the more we understand their business models, the better we will be able to understand what are the possibilities for gains to be played by those types of businesses. So I'm sorry I'm being a bit vague, but I don't want to give too much away. This is our competitive advantage at the moment. But in essence, why is risk important in our business? Risk is important in our business because it is impossible for a tax and customs administration to pursue every taxpayer or to check on every cargo consignment that goes across our border. So the better understanding we have of where the risks are, the better we are able to firstly identify the risks. But secondly, it's about deploying limited resources. So if you have limited resources, the better you understand this, the better you can deploy those resources. So if you have 20 excellent auditors in your organization, you certainly don't have 2,000, then understanding where the risks are on the one hand, or where the revenue opportunities are on the other hand, we clearly must use the 20 on the high risk side rather than on the low risk side. So maybe a practical illustration of this in terms of the way we apply at a day-to-day level, I hope he also is going to be careful. But Master Bane, from a large business side, will give you an insight into how we plan to build a risk system in the large business center and how we use it there.
Thanks, Commissioner. I think maybe if I even go into RLBC, I think it's very interesting to know that OECD recently has commissioned a study on a very similar topic, risk management. And I think the product and the result of the study was in a way to take our time. That's what frequently approaches. What is more interesting is that the issues that were raised are the similar issues that were also facing in the large businesses. On a practical level, what do we look at? I mean, for a person that is regarded as a company as a IRB, will the company that has certain kind of statistics? If you tend to have more of these risk characteristics, you are regarded as a IRB. For instance, we look at the relationship between the accounting income and the taxable income. In the ideal situation, the two should be very close, except the accounting income obviously will allow those deductions that are legally allowed by the tax act. We also look at so-called effective tax rate. Now, the effective rate, the further it is away from the existing tax rate, for instance, currently companies are paying tax at the rate of about 11%. Now, if you find a company that its effective tax rate is moving towards or away from 11% to the region of 20-15%, then you become concerned. Because ideally, you should be paying exactly 11%. Also, something that you tend to also give us indication whether the company is involved in aggressive tax planning, we look at, do they have a tax strategy? Because those companies that have a tax strategy tend to take tax very seriously. Another issue that the Commission also touched earlier on in terms of how often does tax issues feature into the board meetings of companies? Invariably, you find that the MD of the company, or even the MD, not even two that influence a lot of tax issues. Also, is the tax appetite. How often is the taxpayer willing to interpret the tax law different to us? And when you get this gap, there's a good chance that the company will be high. The other one also what we look at is the cooperation that we have with this particular taxpayer. Some of them will ask them for information. The first thing they do, they run to...
Now it's getting some secrets away.
Okay, I might be quiet on this, but you will know why I'm not here next time. Yeah, and I think those are the issues that... Okay, let me protect my job and just give it there. But I think it's quite a very fascinating exercise. And as Commissioner put correctly, with the little resource that we have, you don't want to change those guys that allow it. 80-20 principle. Thank you. Very cool.
Yeah, well done. On the small business embassy, there were two questions, and I'm going to ask the two gentlemen on my right to deal with that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Chair. The issue of the taxi industry and how many people within this industry have applied, the total number of applications that we've received in the taxi industry is 24,000. So all in all, we've received 24,000 applications. 20% of those are new applications. In other words, people who have not been in the register before. Obviously, 80% are people who were in the register before the amnesty process. In terms of the other question that is related to this, relating to the tax-based broadening aspect of the small business amnesty, of the total number of applications that we have received, 22% of those applications are new registrants. So if you look at the 363,000, 22% of those would be the new registrants that we have, that applied for amnesty. 1% would be reactivation. In other words, they were already in the net, but they were not necessarily active, and they've had to be reactivated with the application process. I think those were the two questions that.
Yeah, no, I'll do the same thing. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. Just to add, before I get to the conditions, the majority of the applications, when we presented to committee earlier in the year, we gave you a slide that indicates that the majority of the applications in fact came from the retail and wholesale sector, the business services sector, and the taxi industry. And the kind of 20 to 22% range of new entrants is also the case for, it follows the trend that in each sector that has been about the percentage of people who have not been on the register before. And so that has been the actual broadening. But then of course the reactivation and the bringing back into the system of the other 78 to 80%, you know, that was not compliant. The interesting thing of course that we showed you then was that the lower sector of applications came from the accounting sector and the legal side. The question about convictions is the following. An important thing to understand is that the small business amnesty and the campaign that we ran around it, the intention was not a punitive one. The intention was in fact to get small businesses business ready and compliant for them to benefit from the economy. So while they benefit from having a clean slate, we benefit from them being tax compliant and collecting their revenue. So in the current phase of the amnesty, our focus is on processing and adjudicating the application. And as my colleague explained earlier, that we are challenged with a range of outstanding documentation that we are focusing on. But we will enforce that those who are not compliant, we will enforce, because your mere application doesn't, you know, the fact that you apply doesn't mean that you've got an amnesty. And that's a very important message. And those who documents are still outstanding, we are going to have to go after them. And we are intending fully well to do that, like we are currently doing in the filing season. However, during the campaign itself, we had an enforcement drive that ranged from small and medium businesses to individual taxpayers. And during that time, up to June this year, our enforcement actions involved 988 summonses that we issued, 207 warrants of arrest were executed, and 67 attachments of property took place. During this time, we attached property to the value of 70 million rand during the amnesty campaign. And of course, as we go through with the adjudication process, we will continue with the enforcement on the small amnesty side. Thank you.
I think we must reiterate though that those that were the subject of some of those enforcement actions weren't applicants. It was outside of that process. So we've got to still give the people who applied an opportunity to bring in those documents, prove their case, and as quickly as possible allow us to process those applications as well. There's two questions left. The one is about the cleanup of the contact details and the practical measures taken. Mr. Kisser and Mr. Hall.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Chair. The members will appreciate that for us to have accurate taxpayer detail is quite important to ensure that we can do effects on full administrative mandate. So a number of things. The first is to reinforce the fact that the taxpayer has an obligation, in fact, to update the records when they move or if there's any significant change in their data. But internally, we have, up until now, in previous years, we've used every time a taxpayer submits a return as an opportunity to ensure that the details are correct. We've in the past had address campaigns. So, for example, in the last financial year, we sent out SMSs to about a million taxpayers to just respond to us with an updated address data. We're also using the opportunity via our call center every time there's an opportunity a taxpayer comes in to make it part of our standard procedure that the call center agent will say, you know, the morning search, some check that the address is correct, and they go through that. And then in the real office cleanup, via our liquid maintenance activities, ongoing activities. That, however, in the past have not proved enough. So one of the principal decisions we took as part of our enhanced assessment process is to place greater reliance on third-party sources of data. We also became aware that the institutions that have the best detail of individuals available are the credit bureaus, and have in the last, as part of preparing for the assessment program, we have begun to use them as two of them as reference points for third-party data. So what we did is we took our own data on the taxpayer, compared that to the data that two independent sources had, and where there was a match, we could tick that off as a high probability, high accuracy, and then as the ability to match again reduced, we placed a lower probability on that. Using that, we were able to send out returns to only those taxpayers where we had a fairly good sense that it was a correct address. The result of which is quite evident, and we don't have the final number yet, but to give you an idea, in previous, last year, about 300,000 of the returns that we sent out to taxpayers came back to us as undelivered, mainly because the address was not at the address found, or there was some other error. To date, of the 3.9 million returns that we sent out, only 27,000 have come back as undelivered, which shows quite a significant benefit from the exercise that we have done. And we'll continue to work on that because it's an iterative process to refine that data. But as I said, principally, we, as we move forward, we'll place greater reliance on third-party data. So your information that you have at your employer, at your bank, we should be able to, for example, if you have a change of address, at least pick up the possibility that that happened from the deed register. And so as we get ourselves deeper into third-party data, that together with collaboration by the taxpayers to voluntary compliance, we should be able to improve on the quality and integrity of our data going forward.
Mr. Hall, some of the worst-case stuff that you guys have been doing here?
Thank you. I think Mr. Keith has covered most of it. I think the only part I would add is as we go forward, we're looking to create single taxpayer master file and linking all the various different taxes to and the files we have that are individual related to the individual product types. So you have a VAT record and you have a corporate income tax record and you have a personal income tax record. By creating these overarching master records that link back to the individual subcategories, that will enhance our ability, together with the third-party data that Keith has mentioned already, to more accurately keep track of where the taxpayer data and their details are and how accurate they are.
And this, Chair, does actually ultimately result in a significant saving in terms of postage, paper, printing, and all sorts of things. Which, as we get the process smoother and we learn from this year's experience, we will increase as well. The last question, Chair, was about voluntary compliance and what sort of teething problems are we experiencing. There was also, I think, a question on litigation costs. We gave that figure earlier, the 60 million rand, so we have to deal with that. I think voluntary compliance is the end product of the compliance process of service, enforcement, and education. Voluntary compliance is about what is the culture of the society and how will that society behave if there's no other pressures in that society. So many of the tax administrations around the world dream of getting voluntary compliance, which means that without any interference or contact with the tax administration, would you submit honestly all of your income? Will you submit your return on time? And if there's anything happening that we need to know about, will you actually tell us?
without us having to spend extensive amounts of money in auditing you. And it's all of the factors that we've spoken about before, which give you higher and higher levels of compliance. But there are sort of two sets of studies that are beginning to emerge in work that's been done by the Canadians, Swedes, Australians, New Zealanders, and others. And some of it we're doing ourselves now. The one is, if you like, the social dimension. How much of credibility do political institutions have? Do the people perceive government to be delivering to their needs? And that's then linked to whether people will comply on the tax side or begin to have education there. The other is psychographic. In other words, what's the individual thinking? What's their orientation? Will they take an exit door if it's slightly open? Or would they say, even if it's slightly open, the right thing to do is not to take it and therefore not take it? And part of that psychographic study is the tax administration perspective. Is it seen to be competent? Is it seen to be fair? And then you get a set of behaviors that actually follow that as well. And I think all of those are very relevant for us as well in South Africa. And how we create confidence in the public, government more generally, the tax administration more specifically, is going to be quite important to getting voluntary compliance over the years. But also, what do we as a society find acceptable? And what is it that we as a society will discourage actively? So I think we've had the story before. At the last dry or cocktail party all of us might have attended, and somebody said, you know, I have actually gained SARS. Will we keep quiet or will we pat the person on the back and say, well done, why don't you teach me that as well? Or are we going to say that's the wrong thing to do? And in fact, you will try to find out what the hotline number is for SARS and report the person. And because that's what this is about. We might think that this is just an isolated activity, but that's what the culture of a society is about. It's about what we as a society will say we will tolerate as non-compliant behavior. So all of us, in a sense, share role players in generating the right kind of voluntary compliance. I think we are on the right track as a society, and we've done the right things from all the different players that influence this process. But for our own society, we need to understand these dynamics better, learn from some of the studies that the other people are doing, and see how it applies in our own context. But some of the early signs are quite encouraging. We had one set of figures that were, I think, in the slide. How did we take it out? Yeah, it's on page 27 of the slide, where two surveys that we did showed that the overall positive attitude to the SARS filing season. And the second one said that most South Africans rate SARS that was in the survey at 6.7 out of 10 for SARS. So on the whole, there's a tendency towards the 10, and there's a positive orientation towards SARS and the services that it actually offers. Now the question will be, what are the drivers to make that 6.7 into 8? But also to sustain it over a 20-year period. Because that then is what is a voluntary compliance culture for future generations and so on. Okay, those are the questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Engelchin. I think one would, at the end, then just ask for the sentiments of the committee. Congratulating you on the job well done, and trust that you are going to continue to improve. And, until at some point we can say excellent. I'm sure it is a very difficult point to reach, but well done. E-filing. How? Actually, there is this discrimination between people on e-filing who are given until the end of January, and those of us that are submitting paper are supposed to do it by the end of this month.
It's called affirmative action. So it's affirming those who show a bias towards the trend we would like the country to go to. And it's providing the right incentive to actually do that. So that's an experiment here. I'm not sure how much of it is going to work. My colleagues tell me that for the whole of the last filing season, we had 50,000 people who submitted income tax returns through e-filing. And this year already, notwithstanding that January deadline, the latest figure is 83,000. So we're moving in the right direction. And it looks like the carrot is working. And if you don't want to experience the discrimination, log on to the internet and do the right thing.
But what's the response rate like? Isn't this indicative that if you have a longer, if you're given longer time to respond to the front rate, then SARS is also going to be responding. So if you're taking longer, those that have sent through e-filing and quicker to those that have sent in hard copies.
Well, that's the overall balance we have to get right. And then, I mean, there are sort of green lanes and red lanes or fast tracks and slow tracks in all sorts of environments. And I think what we're experimenting with here, and this is towards that voluntary compliance culture we're talking about, where as a society can we get a deadline and where 80% of our people will do the right thing by that deadline. And I think over the last 6 years, we've gone closer to it, but we're not excellent yet. And that's the overall challenge, I think, we have. Gary, I want to add something.
Thank you. Just if I understood the question correctly, that if you e-file, it'll take longer to deal with. In fact, we are giving people time in terms of payment if they have to pay us. But if you file through e-filing and your data is correct, because we are checking the data now against our third-party sources, the response you get that way is faster than any other channel that we have in SARS. So I just wanted to respond to how it would be better on other channels. In fact, it's a better way to deal no matter what way.
So remember, Jay, when you saw that assessment process, we're still in the early days of that process. We thought it would happen faster, but it's a bit slower. It's the reality I'm at. But ultimately, all of your returns will be out in 24 hours after having been received. And those that are coming in electronically, as you saw, then don't have to go through the scanning process. You're skipping that step. Your electronic return is going automatically into, there's no need to have optical character recognition and intelligent character recognition and checking for mistakes and all of that. There's no need for capturing mistakes because you've done the capture. Hopefully you don't make mistakes as a taxpayer when you actually fill in your details. And that will then fast track the process with the risk engine acting as a SIP. Through which your return has to pass and the test that it will actually put up to you. So I think in about 2 years' time, 3 years' time, it will move much more smoothly. And hopefully even this positive discrimination between the ego approach and the paper approach is one that balances itself out ultimately. But we also have some responses which Mr. Makhushula has brought to some of his queries about disaggregating the people with disabilities figures and we'll let him have it at the end of the meeting.
Do you want to give it to us quickly verbally and then we can also give it to us advice?
Right. Thanks, Chairman. Mr. Mare asked for a categorization of the 1.7% disabled people. Yet in total, as of the 30th of September, 226 people. And then we have grades 1 to 7, of which in grade 7 is the highest grade. We have 14 people in grade 7, which is the highest with disability. 1 in hearing, 4 is physically disabled, 3 with 5. And
and then different level groups, the highest being only around 23 on page 3. So most of them are really distributed equally across the grades, except the grade 3. And then in terms of gender, out of the 226, 113 are female, and coincidentally 113 are male. So it's exactly half-half.
Okay, thank you very much. That then brings us to the end of this session. And once again, we wish you well. So thank you for the job. Well done. At 2 o'clock, we convene here again after lunch. I invite all of you for lunch outside. We meet again with National Treasury from 2 o'clock until the end of the day. Thank you.
Chair, thank you very much for our time. And Mr. Marek, I can be assured that we will improve on those figures over next year. Hopefully have a new set of figures for you next year. But thank you very much for the introduction.